Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
We all want to win the Stanley Cup.
Welcome to
Mile High Hockey Lab.
Mile High Hockey Lab.
Playoff edition.
It's over! They did it! They did it!
Hello and welcome. This is the Mile High Hockey Lab, and you heard it, the playoff edition. We are here just ahead of game number four between the Colorado Avalanche and Seattle Kraken tonight in Seattle. Thank you so much for joining us. My name is Adrian Hernandez. I'm here with Ezra Parter, Evan Liu, Jacob Wendling, Jackie Kay. We are super stoked. Jackie, I got you back. We're here. Can you hear us now?
Yes.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. So thank you for joining us. We're going to talk everything Colorado Avalanche just ahead of tonight's matchup. While I have your attention, please don't forget to like, subscribe, turn on your notifications so that you know every single time we are live. And doing so, let's drop the puck and talk Colorado Avalanche and Seattle Kraken, game four, tonight. And I want to double back a little bit to game three's victory and talk about Nate Dogg, the man with the dog in him. Evan, I'll start with you. Oh, yeah, there he is. There he is, right behind Ezra.
That's hard to point in that direction.
Yeah. So, you know, it goes without saying that Nate had probably one of his best playoff performances in a while, other than, you know, maybe late in the last year's campaign. But definitely so far this postseason. Evan, what do you think about Nathan MacKinnon's performance? And I just want to drop a crazy stat on you before you mention your comments. He has three more points than Steven Stamkos in 43 less playoff appearances. Tell me what you think.
Wow. I didn't know that. That's crazy. I mentioned it in the pregame article for game three about how MacKinnon had only had 1 point in the entire series, and it was an assist, right? I guess you could say I willed it into existence. So you're welcome, as faithful. But no, I mean, that's what you expect him to do, right? That you expect him to come out and lead this team and, you know, provide on a night-to-night basis, right? Yep. And especially with the captain gone, his leadership now more than ever is super important. And so hopefully the guys will take away a lot from that big Saturday night win and take it into tonight.
Yeah, and I'll send this one over to Jackie. I totally agree, Evan. A lot of people thought that, I mean, the narrative after game three was that Nathan MacKinnon just kind of put on a show and stole the game. Do you think that that's true, or does that kind of sell the game in and of itself short?
Yes and no. I mean, looking back on it, probably his goals will be the most memorable, but I think the story of the game was definitely like the combination of what he did plus Mikko and Makar. Mm-hmm. It was like the stars elevated. So I think that's more like the true narrative, but he definitely has a flair for those really flashy goals.
Yeah.
He loves the first round. I think after he put like 20 points on Arizona in the first round, like that's put it like skewed his numbers incredibly after that. Yeah. But like, he always seems to really start hot in the playoffs.
Yeah. And that's a good point. I feel like if you are looking at a first round matchup against the Colorado Avalanche and Nathan MacKinnon's not at the top of your matchup board, you might be making a mistake. But at the same time, it's just so hard when you have Mikko Rantanen and Cale Makar, you know, also pitching in. And that leads me to my next question, which I'll send your way, Jacob. It feels like, at least in this series so far, the Avs have gotten their wins largely on the back of production from their key players and superstars. Do you think that that's something that's sustainable, at least in this round? And then what do you think maybe if they potentially move on, is it sustainable deeper into the playoffs?
Yes and no. I think it depends on what we mean when we say the word production. You know, if it, 'cause
if the lower lines are driving play and, you know, they're not stuck deep in their own D zone, and they're, you know, they're tiring out the lower lines, and, you know, the Avs are playing kind of their style of game, that high tempo, high pressure style of game, then I think, yeah, you can kind of, you know, just depend on the big guys for scoring, because that's why they're there, right? Mm-hmm. The issue, I think, would be if those lower lines aren't pulling their weight and they are playing, you know, in their own end for most of the game, then I don't think it's necessarily a sustainable type of production that the top lines are doing, because then, you know, they have to do everything. So
yeah,
I think if the you know, bottom nine are able to take some pressure off of, I guess, well, now Mikko's on the second line, so the bottom six are able to take some pressure away off the top six. You know, just in terms of puck possession and defending and keeping the other team back on their heels, I think that this can be a sustainable model. But, you know, if everybody's pushed back in their own defensive end, eventually it'll end in catastrophe.
Yeah, that's what I worry about. And I think that's, you can't expect your stars to be on every single night. I think we saw that in game one, that, you know, it's not something that, especially against teams deeper and deeper into the playoffs, if that is your goal to get deeper and deeper, obviously it's everyone's goal this time of year. But Ezra, I feel like it's not necessarily one of those things that has been all that glaring, although true, but we've been beaten over the head with the narrative that Seattle is the deeper team. Has that shown itself in your eyes, or has it been more of about the Avalanche kind of shooting themselves in the foot and giving Seattle's depth opportunity?
I mean, I think that's a great question. I think it's definitely the case that Seattle has shown that it has scoring from all around the lineup. That can't be denied. They've gotten goals from every line at this point. But I think that the Avs lost one game on the back of their own mistakes, and they won two games on the back of their own strength. So,
yeah,
you know, it really comes down to how the Avalanche play, not so much how the Kraken play. They're doing their best, and their best is pretty good.
Yeah, I wrote in the pregame today, and if you haven't checked it out, head on over to milehighhockey.com. We have all of your previews for every single playoff game, and then we also dish out a live thread that you can jump on if you have not access to the game itself. You can actually kind of follow along via our Twitter exchange. But I wrote in today's preview that, you know, I don't mean this as an insult to Seattle, because I do think that they're a great team, but I don't think this matchup is as close as it seemed so far, based on the results. And I do think it's heavily influenced by the fact that the Avalanche have kind of shot themselves in the foot in certain scenarios. I mean, I think Mikko put it best. They had 20 bad seconds in the second period of game three, and they gave up two goals and the lead. So I think if they cut down on those little things, the Avs can really start to get ahead of this matchup. And that kind of all starts with tonight. And heading into tonight, we saw kind of the usuals, one unexpected sort of, but that hit the wire a couple days ago, which is Nichushkin not on the ice today. Helm also not on the ice, as well as Jack Johnson. You know, Evan, I'll send this one your way, Mr. Managing Editor. I don't want to necessarily get too deep into the Nichushkin conversation, because I got ridiculed online for doing so, but it did lead to some shakeup in the lineup. What did you think of those lineup changes, and how is it going to sit for you? Do you think they'll go with a similar lineup tonight?
If it ain't broke, don't fix it, right? Yeah. So I think they're just going to go roll with the same thing for game. I almost said game three, game four tonight. And you know, I think the unique thing that I took away from that lineup when I first saw it, because I missed the majority of the game on Saturday, was seeing that Newhook got demoted to the fourth line,
mm-hmm.
whereas then Nieto had moved up to the second line. Now, I don't know if it stayed like that for the entire game, or if it had been switched around every once in a while. Maybe somebody who watched it more closely can take a stab at that. But I think that's
pretty accurate in terms of ice time from my perspective. Yeah.
It is. Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, who knows about that? I mean, it obviously sucks for Nichushkin, right? Mm-hmm. I think I won't get much into it either, but I think the thing that kind of worries me the most is that he left with security from the hotel. Like, if he just had left on his own and traveled back, like, maybe I'd feel a little bit better about that. But mm-hmm. since it was like with security, and, you know, nobody knows where he is or how long he's going to be out for, I mean, that's obviously the rightful thing to do, but it also mm-hmm. sucks, and it leaves probably, I mean, the Avs, I think, probably know more so exactly what's going on. So then Jared Bednar can make his decisions on the lineup and how he's going to move forward without him, even if it's not just tonight, right? If it's the rest of the first round, the rest of the playoffs, you know, who knows, something like that. So obviously it just sucks, and whatever's going on, we wish him the best.
Yeah, we do wish him the best. And I think that's the main source of people's longing for answers, is just concern based on how I don't know, tight-lipped the situation is out of the Avalanche camp, which is their responsibility and their it's what they get to do. So I don't have any problem with it. I just think that that's what has created a lot of this room for people trying to connect the dots themselves, when in reality, you know, we could be told maybe a little bit more, but that's not up to us. Jackie, Evan touched a little bit on Alex Newhook and how it seems like he and Dennis Malgin and a few others aren't really getting much ice time. Typically that indicates that the coach is having a tough time justifying putting them on the ice. What is it about about Newhook's performance, and what do you think will have to change from them with Nichushkin being out?
Well, it's kind of like Denner doesn't have any choice anymore. Like, yeah. Nieto on the second line, just that's not sustainable. Mm-mm. Because he really hadn't been getting played much at all since he came back over to the Avalanche. So, right. And he did have the 15 minutes. Now, 3 minutes of that, I think, was penalty kill. So that skews it a little, but he definitely did have more than, like, Malgin and Newhook. So, you know, I think Eller is going to play up some.
Okay.
It also seems like they like that Newhook, Cogliano, O'Connor. I think there was some commentary about that today leading into tonight's game. So that could be part of the reason. And not, it's not that it's necessarily a demotion. It's just that's
better
with
combo.
What's available. Yeah, that's kind of the best composition. But yeah, moving forward, you would hope that Newhook will be able to fill in some of that offensive quality that they're desperately missing at this point. Like, it's almost astonishing that they can win any games with the forwards they have. Obviously the Stars.
Yeah.
I mean, the Stars.
I hear you, especially when you look at the ice time, like Malgin and Newhook have averaged less than 9 minutes of ice time in the first two games.
And it's like, yeah, we have the superstars, and I think that'll get them through this series, but it's not going to take them very far. I just think they're missing way, way too much. Like, it's just, they haven't gotten anybody ready to call up. They just haven't done anything. And it's like, this is what you're left with. But
yeah. And I'll send those talking points over to you, Jacob. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, generally, you know, ice time is always the easiest way to read it, everything. And generally, like, if you look at the ice time, the 5v5 ice time from last game, you know, Bednar trusts his top six. He doesn't trust his bottom six. And that's kind of essentially where we're at. And so because of the style that, you know, how Bednar coaches games, he's always going to try and sneak extra shifts for his top guys, especially, you know, in key games in the postseason. And so I think we're starting to see a more extreme kind of version of that. And so that's why, you know, you're seeing a lot more ice time for the top six relative to the bottom six. You know, there were five guys last game who had less than 10 minutes of 5v5 ice time. And I think that's just, you know, to speak to Jackie's point, that there's just not a whole lot of depth there. And it's just, it's hard to keep rolling, you know, four lines. Like, they're all the same line out there. Like, Bednar really wants to get his top guys out as much as possible.
Yeah, I think consistency is really the key right now in this time of year. And when you have something that's working on a consistent basis, I don't think you're pressed to get away from it. You're not really trying to save any. Honestly, the focus for me right now for the Avalanche is getting out of this series as fast as humanly possible so that they can heal and do what it takes to get, you know, in particular that back end kind of sewn back up to its shape that it was previous to all the injuries. And we've seen Josh Manson and Cale Makar return to the lineup as the postseason began. But last year we saw Josh Manson paired up a lot in the second pair with Sam Girard. But so far this postseason, he's been on the third pair with Eric Johnson. And we've also seen some shuffling in the top four of the defensive group. Ezra, why do you think it is that Manson has been in that bottom group? Is it just because he's shaken off a little bit of rust?
No, it's not. He's a third pair defenseman. He's right where he belongs. I don't think there's. I think he did a great job filling in for an injured Sam Girard last playoffs. Okay. That's ultimately what he was up the lineup last year because of injury. He was on the second pair with Girard in the regular season as well. Mm-hmm. But ultimately in the playoffs, the guys that they wanted to have on the ice were Cale Makar, Devin Taves, Bowen Byram, and Sam Girard. And then Sam Girard was out, so it fell on Manson.
Okay.
And he did a great job. Now he's rusty. He's barely played all year, and he's slotting back into the spot that he belongs, which is that third pair and on the penalty kill. And he's doing a great job, I think. I mean, the game one was obviously brutal, but yeah. he's been much better game two and three. And I think as the team has gotten used to having him back there again and playing with him, so is everyone else. So it's a good fit.
Yeah, and we've seen Byram get paired up with Makar and Taves with Girard. Ezra, why do you think that is? You think it's just to kind of spread the wealth a little bit of the shutdown defender?
You know, it's interesting because I think Taves had a rough game one, so it felt like it was maybe a punishment for him. But I really don't see it that way. I see it as a way to free up Girard to be the offensive version of himself that mm-hmm. kind of missed while he's been having to be a defensive stopper, covering the mistakes of a younger player in Byram and of lesser less capable players, the elder statesmen and the Johnsons, mm-hmm. Or whoever else he's been forced to play with, Curtis McDermott, et cetera, et cetera. I think this is a good mix, really. It puts a guy you can trust to be in the right position at all times next to a guy who needs to have a little more freedom to be creative, to be at his best in Girard. And I think with how well Byram is playing right now, you could trust him in that way, but at the same time, you want to free him up to be creative as well. And he and Cale can really cover for each other in ways that nobody else can the two of them together is the brilliant future we've all been waiting for, and it's happening right now. It's very exciting.
Yeah, and what's crazy is, think about this, Byram still hasn't scored a playoff goal, so that I don't know if that's considered bold enough, but that might be a good bold prediction for tonight. Evan, I feel like you were about to add something to that. Do you have something to say?
I was just going to comment on the fact that we are getting a look at Cale and Bo together, you know, for the first time in, you know, however many years down the line it's going to be, right? And it's been a great look. And I think I'll kind of touch and add on to the fact of, like, the power play specifically, mm-hmm. Because we still don't have a power play goal in this series.
Wow.
Shorty. Yeah, we do have a shorty. Seattle got Seattle just got theirs first in the last game. It was in, like, the 42nd Jaden Schwartz goal that was a non-factor goal, right? So in that, in turn, I suggest, what if you try Byram on PP1, like with Makar? Because then think about it. Because then you can have those two right up top, and then you can, you know, have McKinnon, Rantanen, Lehkonen, Nichushkin, you know, whoever you want there in those other three forward positions.
Yeah.
Because Byram and Makar, they're both offensive defensemen.
No doubt.
Right? So, you know, they could be a fourth forward, right?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It wouldn't hurt to try, I feel like. Maybe not in the playoffs because it's playoffs.
Right.
But maybe, you know, start it next season or something like that.
That's an interesting point, though, because if you think about it, the second power play unit has three defensemen on it. It has Taves,
exactly.
Mm-hmm. Girard, and Byram. So it almost would add a little bit of balance to those power play units if you did move Byram.
It would.
To that first unit. Jackie, Bowen Byram's kind of your person, the one that you like to talk a lot about. What do you think of that?
More Byram's always good.
Yeah.
I do feel like in general they leave a lot of creativity on the table when mm-hmm. it comes to the power play. Like, I know it's top five in the league, and you know that's pretty good, but in this type of circumstance, I actually didn't realize they haven't scored a power play goal yet this series.
Yeah.
So that is something that should be a concern, because one, yes, it is a matter of time, but two, like, especially when you might not get a lot of 5-on-5 scoring because all your forwards are gone, you absolutely are going to have to score on your power plays. So I wish that they would, I'm glad that they went with the 3D power play. I think that's one thing that I've been talking about for years, and they finally did it. But it's just so conservative to do it just on the second unit, and especially in the playoffs, they're getting like 15 seconds. Yeah. Like it's like nothing. So yeah, I agree. Like there should be maybe not like your first look of the night, maybe make that a little bit more standard. But like if you've gone through 2-3 power plays and you still haven't scored, you've got to pull more tricks out of the bag. And I think, yeah, definitely moving Byram on that first unit is one thing. I would love to have Kale freed up more as a shooter. Like he shouldn't always have to be back on the blue line with those, yeah, quarterbacking and with those longer range shots. Like if he was moved down closer to the net, he can shoot on either side and his shot's good enough to score from there. So
yeah, look no further than that clapper from basically the circle. So because that faceoff didn't come far back to the blue line, he came and got that thing and just absolutely rocketed it.
Shooting, yeah, that's a good point. He loves shooting from there, from like the top of the circles. That's like his shot. Mm-hmm. So if he could be freed up to actually get set up to shoot from there on the power play, I think that would be so dangerous.
Yeah, we've actually seen him and Makar kind of switch roles. McKinnon and Makar switch roles in that regard, where Makar will kind of go almost to the OV office and start slapping away at those one-timers. Ezra, what do you think about the power play? What kind of adjustments would you make, or do you feel like they're doing the right things? We just haven't seen it result in goals yet.
Yeah, I mean that's what I wanted to jump in and say here is the power play is cooking. It's not scoring. Yeah, yeah. Man, they look so good. They look so good. They're snake bit a little bit. They've hit it, I think, four posts on the power play, if I'm remembering correctly. McKinnon's blasting shots off people's shin pads all over. Whitney C's asking, has Byram ever quarterback the power play? And yeah, definitely with Makar out, Byram got some time on the top unit this season. So did Devon Taves, but he also has quarterbacked the second unit when Taves was on the first. So yeah, Byram's had
mean like when he was in junior, I mean, clearly the best player on his team. Also with Team Canada at the World Juniors. So
there's another possible creative solution is let Makar be freed up for the shot and have Byram quarterback that first unit. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I do like that. I do like that idea. I think that's a fun idea for sure. And I think it could be a good power play, but I also think what they have going is working. The thing that gives me pause on saying things are working is Natushin's gone for however long. So he's a big part of that. He's a big part of why that power play has looked so good. It still looked good in game three with, I think it was Rodriguez who got moved up to the top unit. But you know, it could be worth giving Byram a shot there and letting Rodriguez and Newhook keep in the forwards on the second unit with I guess maybe Malgin. But yeah, I mean, with how much they're giving the top unit over the second unit, it seems like you got to get your time wise. Yeah, it seems like you got to get your five best players out there, and I think Bowen Byram is in that mix.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, at this rate, like you mentioned, without basically your two best power forwards.
Yeah.
I think that's the case. Jacob, I saw you nodding your head. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Jacob, I saw you nodding your head in agreement when Ezra mentioned that the power play is cooking. What's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we need to freak out after a few games, especially when one of the games has been a complete throwaway game anyway. And so, you know, they've got, you know, I'm just looking at the numbers now. They've got 26 shot attempts and 12 minutes and 10 seconds of power play time. Like that's a pretty dangerous power play. Yeah. And like Ezra said, they've hit a couple posts. It's not like they're just passing it out there for 2 minutes and sitting on their hands. And so I don't think there's any reason to worry other than, Vladimir Nichushkin is a central part of the power play. You know, he's the one who goes and gets the pucks after they're firing it on net. And so, you know, maybe that does change things. If they're still not hit the net, now all of a sudden they don't have the guy who can go and get the pucks, then maybe you do have to start moving some guys around.
Yeah, the net front presence is such an important thing on the power play. And I think that does have a slight impact on why it's not working in its current construction, because you need that guy who puts in the rebound off that bumper play.
Yeah, but Arturi Lehkonen and JT Compher can be that guy.
That's true.
They're not obviously Gabe and Nichushkin, but they're very good at it. So
that's fair. I think that's what people are looking for. They're looking for the new Gabe or the new Valeri, right? Or new Vladimir, as Jacob said.
That's all right.
But
no, I think it's a Freudian slip right there.
No, but like I mean that's what people are looking for, right? That's just, mm-hmm. It's the same thing with Alex Newhook. Alex Newhook is supposed to be the new Nazem Kadri, right? Mm-hmm. And it hasn't turned out like that yet. He's only 22. Give him a break, right?
Yeah, can we scream that from the mountaintops with a megaphone a few times more? He's only 22. Yeah, I feel that, Evan. That's a good point. And I feel that way about some of our defenders as well, namely Bowen Byram. People like to throw him at least on social media. I don't know how much weight you hold that holds in your mind. But nonetheless, speaking of social media, feel free to head on over to our Twitter. That was a heck of a pitch right there. But head on over to our Twitter for our weekly polls. This week I sent out one just to kind of get a beat on who – you Avalanche fans think might need to step it up a little bit heading forward in the series. So the question was framed, who would you like to see more from in this series and why? I gave you three options. They were Alexander Georgiev, Dennis Malgin, and Alex Newhook. I also gave an other write-in option. Let's see, Evan, we haven't heard from you in a second. So let's talk, what is your answer to this poll and why?
Yeah, I haven't actually had the chance to physically answer it on Twitter, so I'll physically answer it here. Yeah, I sent it out
like 10 seconds ago, so that's only fitting. Oh, so
that would do that then. Okay. I want to say Alex Newhook, but I did just defend him, so I'm not going to say Alex Newhook. I'll say Dennis Malgin. Malgin, you know, he came in stretches, right? He was ebbs and flows in the season with him. I think, what was it? He was on like a three-game goal streak or something like that sometime in the season, and then went cold and then got like two more in a row and then consistently got some more. So, you know, he's streaky, right? And if he's able to, you know, get that streakiness, who knows? Maybe even starting tonight, you know, that'd be real nice to see, I think. And it would definitely provide some good depth scoring that the Avs, you know, might be looking for, especially when the top guys are maybe taking the night off, right, or being passengers. So, that's my shout for Dennis Malgin.
It's funny that you say that about Dennis Malgin, because that's a lot we have before compared him to Andre Burakovsky when he was kind of in the heat of the moment of one of his hot streaks. And he is very much, like you mentioned, like Burakovsky, in that he does have those hot and cold streaks. Jackie, so far this poll is kind of surprising me. I was expecting people to answer Alexander Georgiev, and we're getting 46% of the vote so far is for Alex Newhook. What do you think? Why might that be, and do you agree or disagree with that?
My answer is a little bit different, but I'll get to that. Okay. Between the two, I think Newhook does have the spotlight on him. People want to see a big goal, a big performance. Like Georgiev, you know, it's interesting you frame it that way, because it's kind of like, has he not been holding up his end of the bargain? Like, I think he has let in a few goals that maybe he shouldn't have, but he's also shut the door and
made timely saves.
He hasn't lost the game. Like, I don't think he lost the first game. So at this point I would say that like he's been meeting expectations.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody basically has. I don't really feel like anybody has just really, really disappointed. I think there's always hope, like the Malgin thing, but he's like tertiary scoring.
Yeah.
Like anything you get right from there. Him is a bonus. So, I mean, it would be awesome if he could step up and have a huge game, but do you really expect that? I don't know. And like Newhook, you expect more from, obviously, because of the ceiling and everything. But until he's in a better role, like, I'm not going to expect him to score two goals tonight playing with Logan O'Connor and
for 10
and
minutes.
Cagliano.
Goal every 5 minutes. That's a goal every three shifts, two shifts.
I think somebody that could contribute offensively, like to see more from, I would say Girard. A, I'd love for him to have a big performance to shut everybody up. And two, I like the pairing with him and Taze. It worked well when Makar was out and they went to that at the end of the season. And I think it's freed up Taze actually to be a little bit more offensive, which is how we saw him score the goal. and he's got a couple assists. But so I've noticed like Gerard hasn't really been shooting the puck or anything like that. And so I think he has more to give offensively, which I think people wouldn't say. People would just say he needs to grow and get bigger and hit people, which he does hit people. He
needs to grow.
Just not noticing it. But I think for me, what I'd like to see from him is just be a little bit more aggressive offensively. And I think that can make a big difference.
Yeah, I'd like to see him be a little bit more of like the play creator that he was earlier on in his campaign with the Avalanche. I think he suffers from being found out a little bit in having played more than most young guys in his style. And I feel like teams have made adjustments that work against him. But that said, that doesn't mean he doesn't have the potential to go back to doing exactly that to certain matchups. I will say, though, just to get back to how you asked, you kind of mentioned that it's interesting that I framed it with I thought Gorgiev would get more votes. I only think that because I feel like a lot of fans have voiced their displeasure in it seemingly being like Grubauer is the better goalie so far in this series. Jacob, what do you think of that? Is there some truth to that?
I mean, in game one, he was the better goalie. And so, you know, there's only been three games in this series. So at minimum, he's been the better goalie in, you know, a third of this series. Like, this is the problem with like trying to make grand proclamations around, you know, small sample sizes is that essentially from after the first period of game two onward, the Avs have basically been the Avs. And I think that they've been playing pretty much up to expectations. And so, like, when we talk about this series, to me, there's a pretty big dividing line after the first period of game two, where it's just not the same team that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. You know, if I had to point to any one thing that, you know, needs to step up in the series as a whole, I would say the fourth line. And, you know, we've had, I think, three different fourth line combinations in this series. So it's not like you can really say what, you know, one individual needs to step it up, but Logan O'Connor has been the only guy who's played, you know, on the fourth line in every single game. And in every game, the fourth line has basically been truck sticked. You know, Matt Nieto, Darren Helm, and Logan O'Connor in 5 minutes and 50 seconds of time together had 22% Corsi and 1% of expected goals. And like, you know, you don't need to have your fourth line driving the play and, you know, but like they got to at least play to like 40% expected match goals, you know, something like that. Like if your fourth line is spending all this time in your own zone, pretty much every shift, you know, that leads to this imbalance in ice time that we talked about earlier in the show where Bednar just doesn't trust them and he's going to, you know, keep hitting the first and second lines as much as possible.
That's an interesting point. And Ezra, you mentioned last week, part of your bold prediction was that you thought that the Avalanche fourth line would score before the bottom six for the Kraken. You look. Yeah. So that didn't happen, obviously, by your hilarious reaction. Are you seeing the same thing as Jacob is?
That changed, I think, what was it? A minute and 20 minute, seconds. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that there hasn't been a consistent mix there, and that was a strength of the team last year was you had Helm, Pagliano, and O'Connor together every game doing what they do. And now with different guys down there, it's every night. It's just not the same. I think a big part of that is Helm, frankly. I mean, he's not the most important injured player. That would obviously be Gabe Landeskog, but he is an important piece who drove that fourth line's play. And with Cogliano also coming back from injury and maybe not being 100%, he hasn't been the same guy either. So, you know, I think you need O'Connor to step up in a way to fill that role. And you also need Newhook to step up and play that kind of game with pace that I think he's gotten better at. It's not really where I want him to be long-term, but he's gotten better at doing it when needed. Mm-hmm. So we'll see how it goes tonight. I think, you know, my expectations for the team are high, and my expectations for that line are not that high, but that's fine. They just have to do enough to get by, and hopefully tonight they do.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. Good enough to get by, and like Jacob said, like 40%.
Yeah, you don't need to win. Just don't get destroyed. Like,
yeah, exactly. Well, I think last week in our episode, Jacob, you put it like, I don't expect you to outscore the bottom four, but just don't get outscored by a ton is essentially what you put it. So And that kind of happened in game one and didn't sort of happen in the following two games, which is, although it happened a little bit, not quite to the extent it did in game one, which is funny. I'm going to kind of open this part of the show up to everybody, but I wanted to dish out kind of one of the talking points that I wanted to think of, which was the way the Avalanche have started these first three games. And it seems as though the Kraken have gotten out on the front foot. I do feel like in game three, the Avs were skating well to start the game, which was a change. But I do think that the Kraken have had a little bit better execution early on. Evan, is there any explanation? Can you offer me any explanation to that? And then when you have an answer that, everybody's just open to communicate.
You know, I think it might just have to do with the fact that it's Seattle's first ever playoff series. And so they're getting, you know, hyped up in the room and like coming out guns a-blazing, right? Yeah. And, you know, oh, nothing's going to stop us in the first 5-10 minutes of a game, right? And so they're going to bring that energy. They're going to bring that push and that power, you know, right away, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas I think the Avs are kind of more methodical. Like yeah. They'll grow into the game and, you know, try and get a feel for things to start off with and then, you know, decide their point of attack, I guess.
Right.
Gosh, I'm sounding like my political science capstone right now. This is the strategy. This is the strategy and the way I have to go. No, but no, I mean, I think that's just kind of how the Avs are. The Avs have done this before. They're in this position. They know what to do and what not to do. Obviously, if they did come out hot like that, like Seattle does, it'd be nice for a pace of change. But then again, I don't, as long as they don't do what they did in game one, then yeah, you know, I wouldn't be too concerned about the slow starts.
I wonder for the Kraken, if it's like, you know, the phrase, it's better to have loved and lost than to have not loved at all. Is it better to lead and lose the lead or to never lead at all? Because I feel like it's almost demoralizing to have the champs almost down and out in game two, just to an extent. You're up 2-0, already stole the first road game of the series. You have the potential to really step on the champs' throats. What do you think about that opportunity? Whoever wants to make comment can.
I will say, actually, because this is kind of backs up into our last point too, which I found interesting. I'm surprised that you think it's Alexander Georgiev who needs to improve, or like the fan base does. Because yeah, he kept the Avs in game two in that first period.
That could have been so much worse.
That could have been so much worse, right? And, you know, I think – I know, too, we've mentioned that, like, I think Georgiev has played, what, like three playoff games before the start of a series?
Sixth game, I believe, yeah.
So, like, it's probably his first NHL playoff
learning curve, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like, give him some time. Like, yeah, he's been great all season.
He's made the necessary save so far in the least important round of potentially, hopefully, the least important round of hockey.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I cut you off, Ezra, whatever
you it's okay. He's let in some goals that I would say are uncharacteristic of him. So I think that's where that comes from. But he's also made the amazing saves that are characteristic of him so far this season. So, I'm with you.
Yeah. Well, is there anything to the four of you that sticks out that we haven't touched on yet?
Oh, I wanted to talk about the starts just briefly. Okay. They've gotten a better start every game. I wouldn't be surprised if they did come out with the better start tonight. I also wouldn't be surprised if, like Evan was saying, they feel it out and then take it from there like they usually do. But really, like, game one was brutal. Game two was bad. Game three was good. So they're on the right track, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, they scored first in like 56 regular season games. Yeah. So, and I don't think the Kraken made a habit of doing that quite as much as the Avalanche did. So I would be willing to wager that those numbers are going to kind of balance back out to the average. Exactly. So we got some pretty good material for bold predictions so far, is all I'm saying. So,
yeah.
It's definitely a good sign that the Avs can come back after not scoring the first goal, because statistically, just in general, that is such a huge indicator of like who's going to win a game. I wonder, and I agree with everybody, I think game three was better. They just happened to get scored on. It wasn't like as terrible as the first two, but they've kind of fallen into a trap this year where if they don't really take the team they're playing that seriously, they tend to look like that. And I wonder if maybe the start of this series against Seattle, I mean, I know that they all say it's 100-point team and blah, 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 but we've seen them kind of like their mentality.
Yeah.
Match basically their opinion of who they're playing. Yep. And you can tell that, like, the intensity and just everything is ramped up when they're playing a team that they point. I don't want to say the word respect, but just maybe fear a little bit more.
It says a lot that this team lost. I mean, I know the injuries were a thing, but they lost to teams like Chicago and yada yada, the list goes on. And but they also beat teams like Toronto in the heat of the of their best success. So it's like, that totally makes sense. And it makes even more sense when you consider the context of winning a cup already last year. And you're like, ugh, do I really got to play, get up for this one against the Blackhawks? Which I know they're never going to admit because they're professionals and it's just not okay to do so. But that's just how I see it, too. I agree with you.
I don't know. It's the point about Seattle scoring first, because I think they did make a good habit of scoring first in their own games. But I don't know. I could be completely wrong. But you know, I think I definitely do enjoy the progression that they've had, as Ezra mentioned, that like it was bad, then good, right? Mm-hmm. So then hopefully tonight is great, and then, you know, Wednesday night is exceptional, or, you know, something like that. Yeah. So pulling out the big boy words here.
There you go.
How about we just go over like the general, like the rest of the series? Because okay. I know that we can go into the controversy of the referees and the other Western Conference series, specifically that Kings Oilers game three time. How do you?
You have a lot to say. I was going to say, how's the LA stuff out there?
You know, I don't know. I haven't, like, I don't have a lot of friends here that like hockey. I don't have a lot of friends here. No, I don't have a lot of friends here that are into hockey. So I don't really have like a beat on how the Kings fans are feeling, but I just watching the game last night, it was amazing how much work it felt like the refs were doing to get the Oilers back into it. It was crazy. I know that that's a conspiracy theory. I know that's not true, but like, man, some of the
you got to keep promoting Connor McDavid somehow, some way,
for real. And that's like good for hockey, I guess. So maybe keep doing it. But, but like the trip call on Fiala, I just that one alone, I was like, okay, it's real. I'm right. That was insane. I don't know if anybody else saw it, but he literally body checked a guy and got called for tripping. It was insane.
Yeah, but, happened twice in two different games, by the way.
Yeah,
two sets of referees called that same terrible call in two different games.
Yeah,
I don't get the instant. This is a whole can of worms that, like, I could do an entire episode on the way officiating and the way it changes in the playoffs. And I don't mean that like I don't mind the play changing. That's actually what it's all about. What happens is the officiating changes, and that's where I have an issue.
And the NHL has a system now where the refs each game for each series are different. So they're moving refs around the country. The refs are getting flown from game to game to game to game. And I question that because, one, the refs are probably getting burned out doing that. Mm-hmm. And two, like, you can't just adjust to how the refs call the game when it's different refs every game. Yeah. So I don't know. I don't know why they do that. But maybe it's to avoid any semblance of impropriety with one rep favoring in one team or something like that. I don't know, but you can, there's a pair. I forget who it is on Twitter. There's this guy who tracks the refs. It's not scouting the refs. It's somebody else, but I forget who it is, but he's like, this duo, man, I'm not giving enough information for this to make any sense, but he identified a duo. He's like, that game is going to be a shit show. And then wherever those two refs go, that game is terrible.
Well, I was going to say, I feel like we've, as Avalanche fans, we've been slightly unscathed so far this year in terms of officiating rhetoric, which is nice so far.
Yeah. At least.
I saw something else on Twitter that was like, the beginning of every series, there's more penalties than usual. And then once you get to like game 5, 6, 7, there's fewer penalties. And then the deeper rounds you go, it's even more pronounced. So it is kind of funny that way. It's like, they're trying to call penalties to set the tone and then completely back off.
It just doesn't make any sense because then you set a press. What I see a lot of teams doing, which is what I think this is what Sheldon Keefe meant when he talked about veteran teams manipulating officiating. What I see a lot of teams do is they set the line. They force referees to draw a line in the sand, but they put that that line at the highest point of what they'll allow in terms of the threshold. So if you move the threshold as far to the towing the line of illegality as you can, the rest of the game can be played dang near close to completely illegally. And mm-hmm. I think that teams do that, especially teams that are slower. And you can't say, oh, it's just playoff hockey, when it's something that teams are strategizing around. That's not playoff hockey. That's playoff manipulation. So I think and that's the word that Keith used, which is manipulating referees. And I think that's true. Maybe that's just gamesmanship, right? If that's what your argument is, whatever, that's fine. But I don't think that there's a lot of class and character in winning that way. That's just my opinion.
Hmm.
Well, it's like, you know that they want to try to even it up. And mm-hmm. so it's just so funny because not so much this year, but like, especially in the years past, the Avs would draw so many penalties and they get penalties early. Mm-hmm. And so then you look at it and it looks like the other team is always getting calls later in the game. And it's not because they're against the Avs. It's just because they already gave the Avs 3 power plays. And you know that they're going to try to balance it out. So some of that is the same thing. Like if you get in a scrum and you already know how many penalties they've called on one team versus the other, you can almost guess how many penalties they're going to give mm-hmm. out.
Yeah.
And I think that was also Keith's point. It was like, well, we were already getting a penalty, so they almost knew that they could do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And at most they were going to get one.
Well, and the other thing is, even in a bigger scope, but along the same lines as that, is we saw against the Golden Knights when the Avs lost in 6, the first game they won, I think, 7-2. And they netted like 3 of 4 power plays. And then the next game, the Avs dominated via the power play very much. So again, in fact, I think they won on a play where Mikko's stick got broken. And after the game, in when they were up 3-1, I believe, 2-1. After the game, Pete DeBoer basically said, these refs are just calling everything for the Avalanche. What happened for the rest of the series? I think the Avalanche may have gotten like 2 or 3 penalties for the entire rest of the series when they had somewhere near like 10 or 12 in the first 3 games.
I think St. Louis did that too. And Berube complained. Mm-hmm. And then it's like the beginning of that game, St. Louis gets a power play.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's another question of, is it gamesmanship or is that fair? Because it is like blatantly trying to control.
That's not rules based. Yeah, that's not rules based. That's the manipulation of the rules, which I guess is competition. Mm-hmm. But
I don't know.
But that's, maybe in North America. I don't know.
In a system where the refs aren't calling the rule book, they're calling how the game feels to them. Yeah, you're going to have things where the feelings mm-hmm. are off and things get weird. And I think it's just, I know it's a hard game to I know call the rule book is a kind of a stupid thing to say because there's broken rules on every play, right?
Every but like, area. Yeah.
But
yeah, nobody wants that many power plays.
I know.
It really is.
Yeah, but it just a little bit more of a consistent approach rather than a to certain rules, I think, would help a lot. Like cross checking. The play that got called in the LA game where Kempe cross checked Bouchard is absolutely a penalty.
Yeah.
But also, that same cross check happened 10 times in that game where the guy didn't fall down, so mm-hmm. it wasn't a penalty.
Exactly.
And it's like, you're right to call it, but also they should have called it before too.
Yeah, not to mention the embellishment calls. It's like if you know that if you embellish, you're going to neutralize the penalty, what does that do to the situation? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, especially when you consider the balance of the power plays, it's like, oh, I can probably go do something illegal, hope that he embellishes, and hope that both guys go off because we're owed one. And so it just gets so weird. And I feel like if they played a little less to the unspoken rule, and played a little more along the lines of just like, if that egregious, yes, gotta call it. You know, I get that. Yeah. That's fair. That's what we used to, I feel like what we used to see in like the 90s and stuff was like, was that an absolutely brutal penalty? Yes, I'm going to have to
call
it.
But in the 90s, it wasn't a penalty until you took your stick.
Yeah, well, he's missing his ear, so I think we're going to have to call it.
Gotta love 90s hockey.
All right, well, let's move on to this week's version of Bold Predictions.
My bold strategy, Cotton. Let's
part of the show
off.
Because I love to make myself sound like an idiot for a living. Let's just cover last week's really fast, and I'll do it with one big giant buzzer for everybody. Ouch. We had under 5 total goals, 3-1 Avs in the first game. I don't know. I think you hit the under. Did you hit the under? Or am I losing my mind?
Yeah, that's the under.
Yeah. No, EJ it wasn't scored. That.
Yeah. No, EJ scores his first goal. That didn't happen.
I feel like it's coming, though.
Yeah,
he was really close with that empty netter. I was kind of hoping that was just going to be how
was
he did
close.
It,
that's but... a good point. Bottom oh, wow. 6 goal, Avs fourth line first. That didn't happen. Jackie, you said 2 of 3 of them would go to overtime. Thank God it didn't, since they all started midnight. And you said first 2 minutes, Adrian, in the game one, that happened almost exactly in reverse. So that's always wonderful. Maybe I should make a bold prediction on behalf of the Kraken this week. But I'll start with you, Ezra. Do you have something for me? Or do you want me to get somebody else?
No, I can go first. I think we're going to see 2 non McKinnon, Rantanen, and Makar goals tonight. I don't really know where they're coming from, but there's going to be 2 of them.
2 goals from not Makar. Okay, I like that.
I mean, they're not even going to get assists on them. Like, truly.
Gotcha. No involvement.
Yeah.
Gotcha. I like that, because that would go a long way towards establishing confidence in the depth in the bottom 6. Jacob, what's your bold prediction this week?
I'll say they shut him out at some point this week. They haven't played a complete defensive game yet. Game 3 was getting a lot better, and I think that at some point we see the fire breathing Avs come out, where it's just one of those periods to open the series. It's like 80% expected goals, and just put Seattle on their heels the entire game.
Yeah, I made a really good to shut out. I gotta play this.
I can't really hear what Jeremy says because. I got my 2 Stanley Cup rings plugging my ear.
Hey, blame it on them recording that.
Fun fact, that Patrick Waugh did not come up with that quote. That was not.
No, really?
Yeah, he said it was Mike Keane in the locker room came up with that that quote, and then Waugh communicated it to the press. So, yeah, that was a Mike Keane quote.
That's really cool. I would have never known that. That's awesome. All right, Jackie, your turn.
Am I going to take the easy one? It was already teed up for me.
Do it. Knock it out of the park, hopefully, too.
Byron scores.
Yeah. I'm gonna make that a spot from now on. Whenever he gets a goal, I'm just going to hit that. Byron scores. Love it. I agree. Honestly, that's where my money's not going tonight, as I like to say. Because I think the combination of us being due a power play goal and us being and Byron being on a pair with Makar, it's just like it's got to happen one of those 2 ways for me. So
it's coming.
I still feel like they're doing overtime though.
yeah. Please God, not tonight. Evan, or sorry, Ezra. I wanted to get back to your prediction about 2 goals from not Makar, not McKinnon, and not Rantanen. Do you have a reason for that, or is that like a hope?
All my predictions are always hopes. But also I just think I think tonight's a game where they're like, hey, we're going to clamp down on this team. Like Jacob was saying about a shutout. I don't know if it's going to be a shutout. I think Seattle's got a lot of firepower, but I do think tonight we see Colorado really take it to them. And that means death scoring comes through.
I love it tonight. Then to go in line with that, I will say that New Hook, it's a multiple point night.
Oh, that's absolutely huge.
Yeah,
that is definitely bold. That's a bold hope. We should change this to bold hopes instead of.
Hope bold.
Ezra said it himself. Bold hopes. These are more hopes than predictions.
Yeah, we're gonna just change it. I'll get new samples and everything. We'll make that happen. So I like all of these, and yeah, the hopes. That's definitely what these are. We're definitely gonna change it to blind hopes. I guess what I mostly hope for is that the Avalanche set up an elimination game in game 5. Because they were unable to eliminate a single team at home last year. And I think they kind of would love to do that in front of the home fans. What's up, Evan?
was gonna say, are you just skipping my bold prediction over here?
Oh shit, you haven't given yours yet? Oh, I already wrote EJ scores first goal down for you. That was rude. I'm so sorry.
You're fired.
Oh,
no, I'm just kidding. Man. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding.
Jeez, oh, I...
No. But
all right.
No, but that actually leads really well into my bold prediction that I was gonna make. Because I've been holding on to this one now for forever. When doing research for my post-game article tonight, because I'm already kind of pre-written it a little bit.
Whoa.
The Avs have not happened yet.
You got the script?
The game didn't even happen yet.
I've got the script. I've got the script, and here's what's gonna happen. All right.
Okay.
The Avs are gonna win tonight.
Yeah.
They're gonna win tonight 4-2.
I like it.
And they're gonna come home on Wednesday night, and they are gonna clinch at home a series for the first time since 2008. It's so, been that long.
Yeah, it has.
Since they what? Clinched any series at home?
At home.
Yeah, clinched any series at home.
Mm-hmm. Since 2008?
2008, I guess the Minnesota Wild. Because I was thinking back, like, obviously 2020 was the bubble. 2021, they swept St. Louis.
Mm-hmm. That was the year where O'Reilly put out a thing that said, we're going to win, and it's going to be fun. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. And then 2019, they beat Calgary in five. And then 2018, they were out in the first round. 2014, they were out in the first round. 2010, they were out in the first round. So 2008, 15 years.
Wow. See, we got more milestones to go.
That is
to
a
go
fun
after.
Fact.
Mm-hmm. I know. I was looking back. I was like, holy cow, that's nuts.
So, all right. So then just to recap, I got Jacob predicting a shutout this week. I got Evan predicting a 4-2 victory tonight and clinching at home on Wednesday. Ezra's got two goals outside of point production of Makar, McKinnon, and Rantanen. Jackie's got a Byram goal. And myself, I have an Alex Newhook multi-point night. Imagine if all of those happened. This would be the wildest next week of conversation that we've ever had.
Then my so-and-so script. Good Lord. I might get called.
Ripped from the Crypt Keeper?
We all might need to sign up for one of those gambling apps.
Right. Oh, yeah.
Oh, so you're getting these from some sort of mummy, these bold predictions? You're the Crypt Keeper now.
Sure. We'll say that.
So if you're getting these scripts, man, you better send them my way, because I'd be a lot less pissed off if I knew the outcome every single night. Well, that's going to end it for us. That's a great way to finish things. You've been listening and watching the Mile High Hockey Lab. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm here with Ezra, Jacob, Jackie, and Evan, all contributors to the MileHighHockey.com and Mile High Hockey Lab. If you haven't already, please head over to our website for all of your latest Avalanche news, and be sure to like, subscribe, set your alerts, and share with your fellow Avalanche fans. Signing off just ahead of game 4, hopefully the Avalanche can take care of some of our bold predictions and take care of the Seattle Kraken tonight and on Wednesday. You fellow Avalanche fans, I hope you have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Mile High Hockey Lab.
Mile High Hockey Lab.